or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
There's always a moment. It's probably a guy, one could probably, without being hyperbolic, call it the moment of truth. And that's the moment when you are either told or you realize it's time to move on. Either time to retire or time they're letting you go or whatever. And it's one of the signature moments in one's work life, one's life overall. So I thought we would take a look at the art, the science, the psychology of succession planning. Whether you're a clerk or a CEO, what is the both practical and, as I said, psychological keys to making it work? Because anybody is going to be filled with emotion about retiring or about getting laid off, about even quitting. There's always going to be some ambivalence. And so I thought we would tackle that that topic. It's a topic I hate because there's something about endings. I mean, we can always devolve to cliches like, you know, when one window closes, a new door opens and all that. And that's, hopefully that's true. And that's actually the first major point, if at all possible. And again, I'm a realist there, not an optimist nor a pessimist. But if you know you're about to retire or about to leave a job for whatever reason, in that interim period between when you are going, between when you realize you're going to be going and you are going, really try to ensure you're going to move to something better, whether it be a better job, or having a good retirement plan. That will make it a lot easier for you to be your best self in recruiting and grooming your replacement. Now, I don't have a replacement here on the line with us, but I have a co-conspirator, the usual one, who is herself. We both are quite a long way from thinking about retiring, but we're not in our 30s. And so certainly some of our colleagues are contemplating it or maybe even have done it already. And so my very favorite guest, so I shall not introduce, and she gets embarrassed when I do it, but I'm so proud of her for having these accomplishments. This is a woman who really had no bigger aspirations than being a teacher. Not that that's a bad career at all, but, you know, I was a teacher. She's gone on to be not only named Superintendent of the Year, not only on the State Superintendent of California's Superintendent of Schools cabinet, but she was just won two major awards as one of the leading technology innovators in education in America, and some other one that I don't remember what it is, but Woman of the Year for her congressional district, Dr. Barbara Nimco, my wife. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you to my favorite other non-retiree planning person.
Okay. But I haven't won all those awards. What was that other one you won? So you got the top 40 technology superintendents in the nation or whatever, innovate. What was the other one?
One of five superintendents someplace doing something. I
don't know. Right. Fooling around, doing nothing, sitting on the beach drinking Mai Tais.
Right. That is exactly what it was.
All right. So what I think the smartest thing to do is I'm going to just riff a little bit on some of these, and then just interrupt me, you know, as you go along. So, first of all, do you think I'm, you know, is there anything you wanted to say about that core concept that if you're going to be leaving for retirement or whatever, you darn better, if you're not going to want to sabotage your replacement, you know, if you're not going to do various things to just make life miserable for those behind you, the first thing you need to be doing is trying to work hard to try to make sure that there's something better ahead for you after you leave.
Oh, there's no question about that. I just spoke to a very dear friend who retired a few weeks ago, and I said, so what have you been doing? And she said, well, it's only been 3 weeks, but it's been a rough adjustment. Well, what are you planning to do? She doesn't have a plan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She just retired because they made her an offer she couldn't refuse.
Mm.
And that's, to me, the worst kind of retirement. And I was thinking about this a lot. I think for the baby boomers, who are the generation that's about to retire, since the youngest baby boomer is going to turn 50 this year,
mm-hmm.
and so the older baby boomers are all in their 60s, There is, first of all, a sense of wonderment, like, how did we get here? What, are you kidding me? In my 60s? How can that be? We were the generation that came up with never trust anybody over 30. And in our minds, that meant people older than we were. And when we got beyond 30, we'd stopped saying that because it couldn't possibly pertain to us. So the notion that we are even near the concept of retirement is so hard to understand. I think we're in denial about it, which is why we don't do succession planning.
Yeah, just for the fun of it, let's. I always believe it's valuable to personalize and rather than talk in the abstract. Let's pretend, let's say it's 15 years from now or whatever, and you're thinking about retiring. What at this moment, no, let's say you were thrust. Let's say, let's say you were forced to retire now. And you therefore had to try to make it as rich as possible, your retirement, so that you would feel okay about mentoring your replacement. Let's say you had to mentor your replacement, which of course is critical to leaving a good legacy. What really would go through your mind? We wave a magic wand. You still have your great health. You know, that's all this, that's all there. But you're dumped. Let's say you were fired. Let's say you were late and you couldn't get another job because as somebody who's over 50, you know, it's not so easy to get a job. So what would you actually do?
After I stopped crying?
Yeah.
I would start looking for what possible kinds of part-time work I could do. I think one of the reasons I don't even begin to think about retiring is because I can't think of anything that I could do that would be more exciting.
But let's force it. Now we're forcing it on you.
And fulfilling than what I'm currently doing.
Well, let's force it. You can't. Let's for a thought experiment to help our listeners. Pretend you couldn't get another job as a superintendent. It was over. It was done. Let's say you did something totally unethical.
Then I would start thinking about what other people who have retired have done. Some of them have gone to work on a part-time basis in the group that
for accreditation
choosing new superintendents. So
right.
That's one kind of job that you can do where you screen superintendent candidates and you help boards with the selection of those superintendents. Some people have gone on to teach part-time at either online or in person at colleges and universities. So maybe they teach a course in education or they go work for the superintendent's academy and they do occasional presentations. So I would immediately start to think about the kinds of part-time things I could do, either on a regular basis, ongoing, or on an occasional basis. But I would be putting my name and myself out there to find things to do because I'm not a person with a gajillion hobbies. I do have acting, but that's not going to keep me sufficiently busy. I am afraid I've outgrown the ingenue parts. There aren't going to be that many parts that I will even be interested in auditioning for, and you clearly don't get everything that you try out for.
I'll try to do, again, my focus is I want to be a little broader than just education because our listeners are so many, you know, so diverse. If I were to retire, if I couldn't be a career counselor anymore, the things that I would focus on is, there is a term that Eric Erickson, the sociologist, used called transgenerativity, which is when we reach over 50, over 60 or whatever, there is a tremendous desire to leave a legacy. So all I'd be doing was looking for as many opportunities as I could to mentor young people, to share what I've learned about career counseling again and again. I would be writing all the time. Probably with less regard. Right now, I have to, when I write, I have to worry constantly about not offending people too much because it can destroy your career, as you well know. But if I wasn't worried about the career, I could afford to be more honest. And that makes me wonder whether reading the writings of people who are post-retirement age might be very illuminating because they may be more inclined to be honest. So I would do a lot of that. And you, of course, you know, most people decide they're going to get very involved in family and in grandchildren and the like. That's not me. Anyway, those are a couple of thoughts. Let's move on. Let's move off of us.
An interesting point that you made. Most people decide that they're going to get very involved with their grandchildren.
Right.
That may be nice for you, but I'm not sure that that family that has the grandchildren wants you involved on such a regular, ongoing basis. They may want you once a week, but that doesn't mean they want you every day. So I think you need to be very thoughtful about where you're contributing and where you're intruding.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko and Robert Nemko. We're talking about the formal term of succession planning, finding and grooming your replacement, whether you're retiring or just simply off to go to another job. What I really want to talk about at this point is kind of laying out a step-by-step plan and then get your reactions to it.
And can I insert one more idea?
Yeah, of course.
On what people can do as they're thinking about what they will do for themselves. There is no end of service positions, things that you can do, being on local boards. There are boards for any taste and interest, whether you want to be on the water board or the theater board or the city planning board or the art commission, the elderly board. There are boards for everything, and they desperately want vital, active people. So when you're leaving a full-time job and you're looking for something that will really be of interest and be meaningful to you, that's something to look at. Look at all the commissions in your local area and start going to some of those meetings. See which ones are of interest to you and then apply for the first opening that comes up.
I want to stress, I know that there are so many listeners who would be concerned that this is sounding elitist. The reality is there are so many, as Barbara says, dozens or hundreds of these little boards of directors, commissions, etc., that, you know, there are people who have been administrative assistants who have joined those boards. So do not, you know, you're not going to join the most prestigious high-level commission that exists, but there are room for just plain folks on a lot of these commissions, especially if you get out of the major cities. You may be living in, Oakland, but there are little towns that are nearby, the San Lorenzos and the San Leandros and the Haywards and the El Cerritos. They all, you know, we are in a very, the government is very labyrinthine, and it has all kinds of different little divisions and commissions and task forces and whatever. And especially if you get out of the big cities, you may find it remarkably easy to get on those kind of things. And yet it feels very important, and it's fun,
it's
and you get to meet
important.
Some interesting people.
It doesn't just feel. And I'm thinking even in a big city like Oakland, you may not get elected to the city council. That's not the first thing you're going to aspire to. But go to a couple of city council meetings, listen to what they're talking about, find an area of interest to you because you live in that city, and there are probably several subcommittees that you could work on that are aiming to make the city a better place to live.
All right,
and
so
they want real people. They're not looking for CEOs.
Right. So now, okay, I want to lay out a plan for succession planning. I've tried to make it apply to people at along the full length of the continuum, but let's say you are somebody with a certain amount of power. You're a manager or a director or a vice president or a president of a company, any of them. Anything other than the lowest level worker bee. So where you have at least some measure of control over how to do this succession planning. And again, this again does not necessarily mean you're retiring. You could be off to a better job, but very often it's very valuable to have a transition, you know, a whole transition period. So the first thing that I suggest people do is that you form a selection committee. For example, maybe consisting of your boss, a key coworker, and a customer. So let's say I was just a mid-level accountant. I might go to my boss and say, you know, I'm fortunate, I'm going to be leaving for another job, or I'm moving to Alabama or whatever, I'm retiring. Let's start this process by forming a small selection committee and get the boss to agree to that. Then the team should develop the job description, but there's a real danger. We tend to think the world revolves around ourselves. Instead of just listing what you've done, think forward. Ask yourself, what at this next stage in the organization's development, what is really needed? You know, what job characteristics, what personality characteristics? And create that. Now, the other thing I want to say about the job description is one of the many, and I have to underscore the word many, disadvantages of decision making by committee, in addition to leading to kind of tepid responses in the job description, plans, in a job description, there is a tendency to throw everything but the kitchen sink in there. And that becomes then a useless tool. The job description can be a fabulous tool for really screening people. So really pare down to the few job requirements that in the end are most critical and most crucial. And that will help you screen applicants based on what really matters, and it's going to avoid your creating a job description that's so intimidating that even a great candidate is deterred from applying. So that's my first step. What's your reaction? Out of anything to say, or should I just go on?
No, I would like to reinforce that, because that leads to something else. The best person to succeed may not necessarily be the person who is directly under you.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the way I got my job, because I succeeded someone who did leave to take a better job or a different job that he wanted more, and a job description was compiled, and they did informally form a selection committee. It consisted of the other superintendents who worked with the county office. So that, although that sounds like education, it doesn't matter. It's like you include people who work with the position that you want to fill, and that meant that I didn't go in the natural order. I jumped up because the qualifications, what people were looking for, seemed to fit me better than some of the other people who might have gotten the job.
Yeah, you were two levels. There was a whole group of people who were above you,
yep,
who were in line to be superintendent, and they passed over them for you. So if you are in a position to look to identify people who could be your successor, you know, you probably don't want to necessarily look three or four levels down. There's just too much learning that has to go on. But don't just look at the level of employee right below you as you're looking for internal candidates. Look two levels down, because that often a rising star could be better than somebody who's higher. But I also encourage you, please, there is a big advantage of trying to find somebody who's an internal candidate. They understand the corporate culture. There's a lot of institutional learning that they know. There is a sense of rewarding the people who are working in the organization for feeling, well, good, if I pay my dues, I have a chance of moving up. But don't just limit yourself to internal candidates. Not all greatness resides within your organization. And sometimes, especially if there's a need to shake things up a bit, it is wise to look externally. But the best job searches are those that give some priority to internal candidates, but also look outside to see if there's somebody outside who's worth incurring the price, that is, of kind of alienating the internal workers and saying, gee, none of us were good enough. But does that make sense? What's any reaction to that?
Absolutely. There may be somebody who you wish worked for your organization. Or maybe when you look at the job description, it will suggest somebody outside. So definitely you want to look at the broadest set of potential successors that you can.
And of course, the whole headhunting industry is based on the idea of trying to recruit people from your competitors, because not only does that get you somebody great who knows your industry, but frankly, because it hurts your competitor. If you're getting a superstar that's one of your competitors, that competitor organization is worse off and you're better off. For some of you listeners who are not crazy about competition, I apologize, but that is a practical reason to look outside to your competitors, because you are going to give yourself a competitive advantage if you, as they say, headhunt away somebody who was at a competitive organization. For example, here at KALW, there are some other radio stations that are public radio stations here in the Bay Area. And while quietly, we feel like we're collaborating, we're all one, but there is, a natural tendency for even public radio stations to want to be the best and compete and get the best people. So if, in fact, KALW got some superstar from one of the other public radio stations, there is a reason at least to consider that factor. One thing I also want to consider is my dear listeners. So if you or someone you love is in the stage where you're planning to either retire or move on and want to talk about or ask about your succession planning, finding and or grooming your replacement, we invite you to call. The phone number here at work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's turn to the a little more about selection. Let's see. Is there anything else? Let's talk a little more about selection. I'm a nut, and I've said this. I'm always nervous about repeating anything that I've said on the radio show, but after 25 years, it's hard not to. I am obsessed with the idea that in selecting people, the job interview is the most ridiculously invalid procedure for choosing people because it's so coachable. Tell me about a problem, one of your failures and what you learned from it. Tell me about yourself. What's your greatest strength and your greatest weakness? Tell me about a problem you solved. You know, those are so coachable. So the candidates could be the worst candidates. And in fact, the worst candidates are generally the ones who spend the most time to prepare because they know that they're really on the merits, on the chop, in terms of their chops, they're the worst. Those questions, you know, do not, and study after study shows that that answers to interview questions do not validly predict performance. The answer is job simulations of difficult tasks that are going to be required on that job. Those can't be prepped for and are much more valid. That's all I want to say, I think, about selection. You want to say anything about that or something else related to selection?
Well, one of the ways of doing that I have seen is to give somebody your inbox and have them deal with it verbally in front of you.
Yeah. Now, here's an interesting
one. What would you do with this? What do you realize needs to happen immediately? What do you do if there's a real problem? How are you going to handle it, et cetera?
Here's an interesting one. Now, let's say I was about to groom my replacement. And I take my responsibility seriously. Let's say, and it's going to take a good few months to really, you know, have that person sit in more of my meetings, ask me lots of questions, me meeting weekly with them to teach them this or that, etc. It's going to take a lot of months. So as I'm deciding whom to select, there's, you know, I don't want to pick somebody, let's say I was older, let's say I was, you know, 68 years old and I'm about to retire. I don't want to pick somebody who's in my age group because I'm going to put all those months or a year to training that person, and that person is more likely to retire soon.
Right.
I'm much more likely to pick somebody who's younger. But you know what? That could get me in jail because that violates the employment laws that says age discrimination is a punishable offense. So how do I? You said, you know, viscerally when you react in terms of common sense. Obviously, you don't want to put in 6 months or a year to train somebody who's likely to retire soon. And yet if I do that and I give equal opportunity to somebody who's in their 60s or 70s to replace me, the chances are I'm putting all that effort for nothing. How do I strike that balance between following the age discrimination laws and not wasting months on somebody who's going to retire right away?
That's a really good question. I think generally, anything I say is going to sound ageist right now. That in the interview process, you're going to, is it illegal to ask what a person's plans are for the next 3 to 5 years? To say, we're looking for somebody
yes.
who wants to stay.
Yes. Because,
that's illegal?
Because that's also seen as sexist. Because if a woman says she's planning to get, you know, that's implying that she's maybe going to try to get pregnant. And that, and then therefore she is prejudiced against on the basis of her gender in employment. So you are, no,
you really can't even say whether your plans for the next 3 to 5 years?
I'm not sure. I think probably broadly you probably can, but you'd have to be very careful.
I think that would be the question. And you would say something like, we're hoping to have somebody who is interested in being in this position for at least the next 3 years. We plan to invest a lot in time and training, mm-hmm. and we want to be sure that after we do all that, the person doesn't take off and use the time and training that we've invested to get a different job.
Let me ask you honestly, if you imagine 100 people being interviewed for a job, and let's say they're all in their 60s, and it's a great job. It's replacing, an executive or superintendent. How many of those, even if they were thinking of retiring in the next year or two, how many think would admit that?
I'm not sure that they would immediately say, oh, yeah, actually, I was just hoping to get the job and increase my retirement for a year. But perhaps it will at least put that seed in their own mind to think about how unethical it really would be to allow the organization to spend all these resources for you just to walk away.
Anyway, let's go to just to see if we can go to the phones. Is there anybody listening here who cares about the issue of retiring or leaving a job and a succession plan, finding and grooming your replacement? If you or someone you love is either in the throes of or has completed the process of leaving a job, grooming your replacement, maybe entering retirement, either want to tell you a story or ask us a question about how to perhaps make it more effective. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. So now, let's talk about what? Let's see. Let's talk about, how about the situation where it's a business that you are trying to, you've run the business for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 40 years, and now you're ready to pass the reins, change the guard, pass the baton, choose your metaphor, to somebody else. Do you have any thoughts about the wisest way to choose somebody to replace your yourself in this business you've worked so long and hard to develop?
I think if it's a business, there's an inherent desire to pass it on to your children. And that can be a great thing. I have seen many children who, I was talking to a woman last night whose dad was a farmer, and she took over the farm. He's retired now, and she's running it, and she's loving it. And, of course, dad's very happy that it stayed in the family. But, unfortunately, all our children don't always want to do what we would wish they'd want to do. And if your child is either not terribly interested in continuing in the family business, or worse, interested, but you're feeling that the child is really not capable or won't do a good job, and you know that because you've been watching them all these years, then it's the right thing to do to go outside and protect the business, which in the end is for the family.
Yeah, well, family or not, there's something about, you know, if you've worked hard to create something, you just don't want to see it ruined, whether it be by your child or on the other end of the continuum. You know, very often people sell out their businesses to larger companies, and too often the companies, to make a few extra bucks, they'll either make the product cheaper or provide worse service or whatever. So it really is your legacy you're leaving, whether you're whether it's a business you're selling or your administrative assistant who's passing the mantles on to, you know, to your replacement. You know, it is your legacy, and as a key signature part of your life well led, making sure that it goes to somebody who's going to cherish your baby feels very, very important to me. The phone number here, if you or someone you love has got an issue around succession, that is, replacing yourself, either because you're going into retirement or another job, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello.
Would that be me?
It is.
Hi.
Hi.
And,
you're cutting out. I can't hear you. Is there something? Oh. No, I'm not here. You're going to need to hang up and call back on a better line. You sound like you're on a cell phone or a cordless. Let's go to the next line. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. It's your turn on the air. Hi, it's you. Are you there? No, we've lost that person as well. Such is life.
It's you and me, kid. Just like life.
Okay, right. Very good. All right, so let's go to the to kind of the concluding segment. Let's go, you know, we've kind of, I think, milked this as much as necessary. Is there, but first of all, let me ask you a softball question. Think about what we've talked about this half hour. Is there anything we haven't discussed regarding the idea of finding or grooming your replacement, whether it's whether you're a clerk or a CEO or you're running selling your own business, that we haven't yet discussed or something you want to definitely emphasize?
I think one of the hardest things is to try and hire somebody better than you.
Great.
Than you are.
Great point.
Particularly in a situation where you're being forced out, because there is a huge desire to get even. That's just primal with all of us. And so you'd love to have them hire somebody who wasn't nearly as good as you, and then they're going to say, oh, my God, what did we do? This, the person that we got rid of was so much better than who replaced the person.
Right.
And so I think that's the hardest thing. If you're leaving voluntarily, even there, you don't want someone to show you up. Once you leave, they figure out all the things that you weren't doing so well. But just to recognize that each of us brings different things to the job. You craft the job, I learned from you, in your own style. You emphasize on the job the things that you do best, and you try to do more of those and try to find someone to help you out on the things that you don't do as well, and you can trade those kind of skills around. So find somebody who perhaps has a different emphasis than you do. That won't make you look bad, but will help the organization.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, there's one of the most, your highest callings, your highest, the most important efforts you can do is to find somebody better than you. And it could be different, you know, it shouldn't be necessarily different. It should be, what does the organization need?
Right.
Then find the best person for what the organization needs moving forward, and then working your butt off to mentor that person. That allows you to then leave the job feeling like you have really left your mark on the organization and just lived the life well led. So we,
and that rule applies to everything. When I was hired to come to the county office, the person who hired me said, my rule is always hire somebody better than you are. And I have tried to do that, and in one instance, we didn't do that, and it was a disaster. So, yes, always look for somebody who is better, smarter, more capable in areas than you are. That's the person you want to have working with you. It makes us all look better.
Sounds good. Now you've got the callers back on the line, so let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello.
Is me?
Yes.
Is that me?
Yes.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I work for a very large not-for-profit corporation, and we have 700 employees, and about 100 of those are at the managerial or executive level. And what I do, one of the things I do, is help people learn how to make good hires.
Right.
And I support the hiring process of executives. And the piece I haven't heard yet, which will make or break a hire, is the culture match.
Yes.
Good point. What we talk about is that every hire, whether it's frontline staff or a vice president, is a research project. And you're looking in two areas. One is, it's quantitative research. Do they have the degree they need? Do they have the number of years of experience or whatever it might
degrees
be?
Are terribly poorly predictive. I hate degrees as a screening tool. It's used because it's convenient and it's objective, but it's horrible.
Well, in my very small anecdotal experience, it's not a predictor of success.
Nope.
But without it, it can be a predictor of failure.
Some of the best people are those who said that, you know what, all this school and all this money and all this abstract arcana is not worth it. I'd rather drop out of school and learn the real world. Especially if you're looking for a bold thinker, somebody who...
Well, in my field, you have to have a degree, so that's a moot point.
Okay.
But I think the other part is that it's a qualitative exercise.
Yeah.
And we never hire just based on an interview, and at the higher levels, we see people probably 5 times before we hire them. And we've had people who've had the skill, who've had tremendous accomplishments, and we have not hired them because they're not a culture match.
Right.
And so you have to know what your culture is, and you have to know really how you operate, which requires some good introspection before you can really tell whether this person really will fit. Because somebody can be nice and fun and amiable. It doesn't mean they're a good culture match.
Well, let me ask you about this. I mean, you know, this notion of culture, I'm well aware that there are different cultures, but in the end, you're depending upon the individual person, the individual job. There are some jobs that require a tremendous amount of team playing, being able to do well in meetings and listen well and build on each other's, you know, comments and whatever. And there are others where you can be a cantankerous nerd, but
that's
brilliant.
Right.
Sure. And so, but it's not a corporate culture question as much as an individual job requirement question.
It's a combination. It's a combination, because even that person who might be in the closet by himself being cranky at some point may or may not. I mean, it's very rare that an individual contributor doesn't have to relate to anybody.
But what counts?
But if you have that, then that's
okay.
Fine.
That's true, but you want to make your hiring decision based on the predominance of what they're going to be doing.
Of course.
And so, well, but that's where the concept of a corporate culture, and too often you hear a little annoyance in my voice, and that comes from the fact that most HR types, when they hire, because they are by personality, they like the collaboration, teamwork, nice person, tactful type person, and they end up hiring too heavily on that for all positions, thereby excluding really amazing candidates who, for positions where all of that team player stuff ends up being tertiary. And so,
right. But with all due respect, I think you're creating a straw man because you're making assumptions about what everybody does. And that may well be, and it may be that our organization has a lot of really insightful people because we don't fall prey to what you're describing.
It's not my assumptions. You were talking about your workplace. I've heard from thousands of workplaces that is hegemonic. This notion that everybody needs to be a team player and be tactful or whatever, It may be your organization is the exception, but without question, that is a hegemonic view, especially here in the Bay Area, that accentuates flattened hierarchies.
My point to you is that when I said culture match, you equated it with a hegemonic view that everybody has to be a team player. That isn't what I was saying. That's where you took it. I just want to be clear about that.
Yeah. Well, that to me is the hegemonic culture. That is what is normally defined as the most central aspect of culture, which is why I responded to that. I also want to thank you for the call, but I also, after you, when we hang up, I want to talk a little bit about how one does assess culture match. So thank you very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Barbara, I'm aware you're listening, so I'm just going to lay this out and then get your reaction. Simulation, again, is the best way to assess culture match. So, for example, if that person's job is going to be running a meeting, you have that person run a meeting with the actual participants there. It could be an abbreviated 10-minute version of the meeting, but that's going to tell, does that person have the cultural attributes? You could stretch a point and say there are other cultural attributes that count, like that, profit is the most important thing. But even in a hard-bitten corporation, that's not really true, and certainly in nonprofits. In the end, culture does come down to how, do you play nicely with children? Do you play nicely with others, Do you agree with that? And that simulations like that, like running a meeting or whatever, that's going to show how well you play with others is the most important cultural attribute. And that's pervasive across almost all organizations. You don't have to spend a lot of time figuring out what your corporate culture is or nonprofit's culture. Do you agree with that?
Partly. I think, yes, you would want to give the person the experience of running a meeting and interacting with these people in a variety of committees and situations and stuff. Hopefully you've been doing that for a while. You certainly aren't going to do it on a one-time basis because the first time somebody who's not used to running a meeting, the first time they run a meeting, particularly with you sitting there watching, is probably going to be a nervous wreck and may not be able to do the kind of job that you want. So I would have them run a meeting and then talk about it, give them feedback, have them run another meeting. You also probably are not even considering the candidate unless you have seen them fit in with the culture of your organization.
Yeah, well, but I mean, if it's an outsider in the real world, you're not going to spend that much time. It seems to me that if I'm hiring, I would put the person in two or three different simulations of the kind of tasks. Maybe one one-on-one meeting with a techie. Maybe it's a meeting in which you're brainstorming. Maybe it's maybe 3-5 minute different kinds of meetings, because culture only matters when you're interacting with others. I mean, there's no culture that says I value laziness. So we know we want you to, somebody who's worked hard. We know somebody who's, who can both follow instructions but yet share ideas. There's, this notion, there's just too much emphasis on microanalyzing what the corporate culture is. Every damn organization wants the same thing, basically, overall. And in my judgment, puts too much emphasis on this team player thing, because some of the very best employees of all are those who are terrible team players and outstanding individual contributors, and yet they get eliminated because of this thing called organizational culture. And that's why we roll our eyes when we see the endless numbers of mission statements about our corporate culture. It ends up being enormous. All those retreats and all those get-togethers and systematic surveys and aggregations of it, and it just feels like we're wasting too much time on something that is obvious to begin with. What do you think?
Somewhere between what you said and she said.
Okay. Anyway, all right. I think we've worked this topic to the bone. Again, I want to give you one last closing comment. What else do you want to say about finding and or grooming your replacement, whether you're a clerk, a CEO, or a self-employed person?
Well, my comment would be about looking around at your organization. In preparing for the show, it really made me start to think about how many people in my organization will be turning or have already turned 60. So we've been burying our head in the sand about thinking that we're all going to be this one happy family, on and on and on, and we're probably not. And so it's time for us to start looking at people and saying, what are your plans for the next 3 to 5 years? And if you're planning to retire and you know that, would you let us know so we can start doing the succession planning we need to do? Because with a large number of senior management leaving, we could be in a world of hurt.
And it can be a very, really a wonderful cap, done right. Succession can be a wonderful capstone experience. The idea of finding your replacement, mentoring them wonderfully, leaving the organization better than when you arrived, and leaving it in good hands feels really good, whether you are going to another job or you are retiring. So, Barbara, thanks very much for joining me here on Work with Marty Nemco, and I will look forward to seeing you at 5:30.
Okay.
All right, Karen. I love you.
I love you, too.
Okay. Bye-bye. She, you notice that little hesitation there? There was a pause that that spoke volumes. Not really. Anyway, I do. Now we're going to turn completely to you, but it doesn't have to deal with succession at all. If you or someone you love has a work-related problem, whether you're a clerk, a CEO, whether you're 17 or 77, whether you're in a for-profit, non-profit, government agency, or self-employed, any kind of work-related problem is something that, you know, at the risk of hubris, I usually can solve. I mean, I've been doing this 25 years, and there's very rarely a caller who calls where I can't be of some help. So the price is certainly right. It's zero. So for a three-minute, what I call a three-minute workover, feel free to call right now. It's a good time while the lines are available. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Those of you who are regular listeners to the show know, I am the issue of the era and the issue of this certainly related to work is the notion of the hollowing out of jobs. The Economist's cover story this week also talked about the crushing wave of jobs, and going even further, the you know, even things like airline pilots, even soldiers, even the lab techs who used to do biopsies, those are all going to be automated. Instead of all these big data miners, it's going to all be mainly done by computers. Typists, there'll be only a small number of jobs, and I'll just tick them off, that are going to be very resistant to being taken over. Somebody like a pastor, nobody's going to replace the minister. Nobody's going to replace an editor. Nobody's going to replace a dentist or a fitness trainer. So there are some jobs that are going to be impervious. Actors, firefighters, these, probably economists. There's too many variables to reduce to a computer. So anyway, there will be some jobs, but I keep trying to envision different scenarios. And I wanted to take what I call, this time, I want to take a kind of a radical liberal scenario of what's likely to occur. It seems to me as ever more jobs are automated part-time than whatever, we're already trying to redistribute more resources from corporations to people. Obamacare puts the cost of health care on employers. You know, all the Americans with Disabilities Act, you know, regulations, you know, protecting the environment, protecting humankind. These are employer costs. So that's going to, like the frog in the pot where it's continuing to boil, there's now talk about raising the corporate income tax, even though it's already double taxation. I think that's going to occur. I think because of immigration and demographics and the media, we're going to have ever more Democrats elected, and therefore we are going to tax corporations more in various ways. So what's going to happen? The big corporations can survive, you know, the Apples and the Googles and whatever, because they don't actually hire that many people. Unlike in previous ways where the large companies like General Motors, it was manufacturing intensive, so they needed a lot of people. But Google and Amazon and all those companies, they only have those like top, you know, 10 corporations. They only hire, and I have the number wrong, but some tiny, like 150,000 people, not some big number. these tech companies. So unlike in previous generations where the advances in technology were ever going to create a lot more jobs, in an information society, there just aren't going to be that many jobs. So the big ones are going to survive. The Googles and the Apples and the Amazons, they're going to survive, no problem. Even if we, you know, continue to tax them more and more and more and more. But the weak companies will die out because they just can't survive in a global economy with all those additional burdens put on them. And then some of the big companies are going to get fed up, and there's going to be other countries like, you know, I won't even say, but other countries that will be really eager to have a big American corporation changes domicile to it. I'm just making up Luxembourg. And so we're going to lose some American companies to them. So what's going to really happen? It seems to me that you're going to have only a small number of very high-level people working, and a lot of even the low-level work is going to be automated. So what's going to really happen is corporations are going to be forced to lower their prices. Something that doesn't, you know, something that's very resource intensive, like a car, that the prices of the steel, the prices of the rubber for the tires, the cost of labor is going to go down. So the cost of items are going to go down. But I think I think all of the imported stuff, I think there's going to be ever more tariffs. So there's going to be a movement toward people spending their money on small, simple things. I think there'll be some more locally grown produce, things like that. I don't think things like shirts, they're just too hard to loom, to make cotton. Corporations are going to still make the cotton for shirts and manufacture the shirts and toothpaste. There probably will be some cottage industries creating that. But it seems to me that in the end, there's going to be maybe 30 or 40 years, a smaller impact of corporations on day-to-day life. They'll make a few things we have to have, like washing machines and refrigerators, but the car industry is going to die because nobody's going to be able to afford these expensive cars. They'll try to lower the prices enough to accommodate the fact that most people don't have much money, but I still think people are going to be buying and keeping their cars for 20 and 30 years. So it's going to be repair shops that rebuild engines and rebuild transmissions. I think we're going to be living that way, and we're going to be living simpler. We're still going to be a capitalist society because the incentive of, or at least a mixed society, where I think people like the idea. We do like the idea of competing to create something better. And if everybody gets the same, we're going to have the problems that we had in the Soviet Union of low productivity, low motivation. So I think we'll have some sort of simple capitalism, but I think people will live more simply. Corporations will have smaller impact, except in high technology, where people will be able to afford it because the actual per unit cost of software is very small. So people will live a simpler life, but it will be technology enhanced. Smartphones, the actual cost of adding a piece of software is near zero for an individual. So I think we're going to have a tech-enhanced life that's more like the 19th century. That's my current vision. There's, you know, playing out a liberal scenario. There's all kinds of scenarios, but I think this show would be abdicating its core responsibility because there's no question that the most important trend in America is the decline of middle-class paying jobs. And what's going to happen is just critical for us to understand. All right, all the lines are lighted up. Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Hello.
Hello, is this me?
Hi, Marty. Hi.
My name is Alex.
Hi, Alex.
And I think you are the best in the world.
Wow.
And not just in the Bay Area, and I'm calling from Europe.
Wow.
And I think many of your listeners just take things for granted, not just in terms of jobs, but also in terms of your services that you give on air for free.
Wow, you're really something. You would think you were a plant, like I was planting you in the audience. Continue.
Yes, I planted myself in your audience for several years now.
Well,
so I decided to call today.
Wow. Were you just calling to praise me, or is there something you want to ask or say more specifically?
Yes, I would like a career makeover.
Great, love to. Of course, I'm highly motivated right now to give you one. So tell me about your situation.
I would like to start a new business.
Yes.
Divorce project management for men.
Okay.
I just finished my 2 years of divorce, mm-hmm. one of them full-time, mm-hmm. in two countries. And I'm a lawyer myself.
Yes.
And my wife is a lawyer.
Yes.
And And then I realized at the end of the second year that actually lawyers don't help. Mm-hmm. And they the issue is that they cannot just define the scope of the issue because they just deal with the tip of the iceberg. So what do you think?
So let me see if I understand. I'm going to tell you my vision of what this would be. So that when a person, a man or a woman, is planning a divorce, there are many factors that need to be taken into account. Children, the career, loneliness, vindictiveness from family members. It's a very complicated task. And somebody who's a mentor or a coach to guide them through that process, either in helping them, you know, throughout all of what I just said, avoiding lawyers where possible, using mediators where possible, but perhaps confining the role of the lawyer to a smaller component, perhaps just drafting the agreement. Is that what you're envisioning?
Yes, and about that, I think divorce is a project.
Right.
And in many industries,
right,
there are procedures for project management, program management, portfolio
right.
management, you know, those many things. And I quit practicing law about 8 years ago, and I worked in business development for mining and oil and gas, and then project management
mm-hmm.
for oil and gas.
Mm-hmm.
And I found when I could just shut down all my emotions, I found that divorce is a project.
I agree.
I have to go through steps, step by step, and relax. And deep, you know.
I completely agree.
Deep breath and so on and so on.
I completely.
People
agree.
Lose their minds.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there's as a brand new idea that I'd never heard before that makes perfect sense, whether it's for a man or a woman. The idea of taking somebody being their coach through this process is invaluable. And yes, viewing it as a project, but also, of course, acknowledging the emotions that are there, but trying to reduce it to a project management problem, and you're being a consultant, I have complete optimism about that. Again, success is only 5% of it is the idea, and 95% is the execution, but the idea is a slam dunk. I can't tell you how many men and women who are thinking about initiating a divorce are absolutely terrified of it and stay in a bad marriage forever because they're just terrified of everything that's going to occur, getting taken to the cleaners by the courts, having this enormous fight about the children, etc. So having somebody out there to be, like you said, deep breath person taking their time sounds great. What question, if any, do you have for me about how to make that great idea a success?
Do you think that this service mm-hmm. can be more to businesses, to lawyers and law firms, like an integration business?
No, they're going to be afraid. No,
integration
no.
cases?
No. They're going to be afraid. The lawyers are going to be afraid you're going to take business away from them. I would go directly to the people planning a divorce. And if you are somebody who's, you know, how to market to get to those men, because men is, or women or whatever, planning a divorce is such a wide market and it's not easily targetable, I would probably, if I was more of a writer than a speaker, I'd write articles about it and put it in publications that used to talk about men, in men's publications that are aimed at people. Most divorces occur in people's 20s and 30s. So I'd look for publications that are read by educated men who have enough income to be able to afford this kind of consultant, men in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, and maybe even executive publications written for executives because they have money and their spouses are much more likely to want to take them to the cleaners. So I'd either write an article for them or I'd give talks at conferences that are overrepresented by people who are in their 30s and 40s, 20s, 30s, and 40s, who are of substantial means. It could be a business conference, a nonprofit leadership conference, or whatever. Does that make sense?
Great. Great. I thank you so much, Marty.
You're most welcome, and I appreciate the kind words, of course. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hello, I'm calling on behalf of my spouse, who's a stock person at a department store in women's shoes.
Okay.
She keeps winning Employee of the Month.
Very nice.
She's been there for 16 years.
Okay.
The new director of the store is very accessible and is around a lot, and she's basically on a first-name basis with him because she does such excellent work and has been recognized publicly for that.
Okay.
In addition, when the new head boss came on, there was a survey done of employees, do they feel like they can move up in the company?
Mm-hmm.
And it came out no. So he came around and said, anybody can move up if they want to, yada, yada, talk to your managers. Meanwhile, we go on the website, and there's this whole thing, university for, you know, creating management, right? For, what do you call it, developing management, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which she wasn't referred to. She's 55 years old,
mm-hmm.
and she's now got a repetitive strain injury,
mm-hmm.
and very stubborn about, you know, she wants to keep doing that job. So I'm just wondering what kind of approach. She does know that she, you know, she can't do that for the next 10 years.
Well, I'm hearing two things.
Yes.
I'm hearing you wanting her to move up into management because of the repetitive strain injury,
uh-huh.
but she's saying she wants to do it. So if she, you know, if she, and I know she, you know, that her RSI is getting in the way, but,
yeah.
you know, does she want to, if she wants to stay doing this job, can you really, is there really the issue more of, you know, are you trying to push her where she doesn't want to go?
No, not really, because she's like, kind of gone like, oh, this is, she really got an idea that like, oh, I can't do this because of my arms forever.
Okay, so.
The issue is, you know, where is that mobility that they're talking about?
Well,
how does she activate it? You know, it seems like she has to assert herself more because she's so good at her job, nobody wants her to move out of there.
Right. So the answer is not rocket science. It's, you know, don't, what's in the website is, that's, everything that is policy that goes on the website, that's just crowd control.
Yeah.
That's designed to just keep everybody in their place and they
right.
will, you know, keep everything systematized.
Yeah.
You know, the obvious answer is to have a heart-to-heart either with her boss or with some other person who is a gatekeeper for this, whether it be the executive training program, the, you know, that, you know, corporate unit, whatever it's, you know, Nordstrom University or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
You know, just very professionally.
Yeah.
Lay out, you know, I've won employee of the month X times, but I won this, I got this, and I feel, and she can't just say she's good at her job.
Right.
She's got to argue for why she would be a great manager or a great whatever it is she wants.
Right.
And so that, for example, let's say she was just in, like, she says she's in stock, so she's just, basically she stocks the shelves and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, there she's got to talk about an example or three where, let's say, the boss was away and she had to take on some supervisorial responsibility or
right.
management or strategic
right.
planning or whatever, and list both her accomplishments as the individual contributor as well as the little signs that suggest that she's really has management potential. And that is the answer. That is what she's got to do.
All right.
All right. I thank you very much for calling. Work
thank
with Marty
Nemco.
And that is the show for today. Sorry, the rest of those of you, we didn't have a chance to get to everybody. So please call back next week. I do love your calls. You do make the show and also, you know, candidly, makes my life worthwhile when I feel I can help folks. So please do call back. I do care a lot. That is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers. And continuing this theme about what the hell are we going to do about the hollowing out of jobs in this country, I'm very excited. I have more reason to believe that this next guest is going to be have good answers for us. He is Andrew McAfee. He is the MIT workplace futurist and author of a brand new book, which was actually the subject of the Economist cover story this week, The Second Machine Age. We will talk about what will happen when the jobs are gone, what we can do societally, what we can do individually to protect ourselves. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.